You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today I'm talking with Aishan Hutchinson. Aishan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Aishan, you're talking to me on April 22nd in 2020 and in the middle of the pandemic, and you're, well, we hope it's the middle of the end or something, and you're in Ithaca. You're teaching at Cornell. We're going to hear some of your poetry today. But first, I feel like I should ask you, what is it like there? There's a shutdown everywhere now. How is that affecting your immediate, I guess, landscape?
Well, it is, I guess, in the general sense of the disease across the nation, it's present here. Present in the sense of absent streets, nobody really roaming the streets as such. But Ithaca is a very scanty place anyways. It's a little hamlet upstate, and so not like the bustling New York City. So it's not unusual to see not a lot happening, but the sense that the absence of people or the absence of anything of the usual that used to happen comes home with a kind of eerie reality that we are living through something devastating. So that is certainly present here and has, you know, changed the landscape. Ithaca being a college town mostly, and a month ago or so, all of the students were sent home. So the presence of the activities that really bring this town together no longer here is certainly felt, and you know. But on the other side, things are proceeding in a sense in their usual ways. I'm not a complete recluse, but I am. When I'm not traveling for reasons for readings and so on, I am usually home in a kind of solitude and working. So that is continuing, and I am grateful for that, to be able to have a comfortable space to read and write and think and meditate on the self, but also what is happening around us.
Yes, it's such a contrast, isn't it? I know you're gonna hear from a new poem you've written as well as some older ones, but just to speak to what you're saying a bit, what I find so surprising about, you know, I'm also, I don't think of myself as a recluse, but I'm at home, I'm reading and doing more things than I normally do, some writing as well, and I realize when I go outside, it's quite a shock, and even now, I'm in New Haven, also not New York City, but it's quite shocking to see masks everywhere and to go into the post office. It's required a mask everywhere. It makes me see that what we have at home or what I have at home is a kind of a bit of a bubble of denial to some extent, because it's so different on the outside, but at home, it's easy to feel like this is as it always was. I'm home alone reading a book. And you know what I mean? There's a kind of a disconnect there that seems, well, to me anyway, very upsetting, really, and puts things out of balance.
I agree, yes. One can't help but noticing that. And you realize that it's a, you know, we're all connected, and the human hum, the noise of in the distance is a part of what keeps us going. And to suddenly have that turned down or off is scary. And at times we probably don't realize our connections and how much we need our distant hums happening. And I think we're living through a great sort of, obviously, psychic disease, and because things are so unpredictable, and certainly there's going to become already a massive shift in the way that we relate, that we are in a state of worry. in a state of disease. But for certain people, not that this situation is familiar, but for some, this is an intensified reality that people have endured, and so in a way, the uncertainties will be faced with a kind of resilience. There's going to be a need for greater connection to learn from each other how to deal with the realities that will be put in place when the noise of the human bubble returns. It will return differently, and we will have to be certainly ready to engage with each other and figure out how to find harmony henceforward.
Yes, that's certainly true, and also quite unknown, of course. What is the poem that you're going to read? I know you're also writing now. I mean, to speak to a little about what you're working on right now before you read, what are you doing in terms of your writing at the moment?
In terms of my writing, a lot of note-taking. I was working actively on a play, and unfortunately, I've sort of put it to the side a bit. I don't think I'm completely stuck. I just want for it to, once I started to craft the thing, I was going down a direction that I felt that the draft needed to step away from. So I put it to the side and wanted to do some more reading around the subject matter. The play is about or set during the period of the Maroon Wars in Jamaica. And the Maroons were runaway slaves who set up free communities in the hills, some of which are still active. And I grew up, close to that kind of condition. So this play deals with a moment in the history of the Maroons. And I've always wanted to write this a play that deals with this, and I was asked to do it, which got me to sit down and really started to draft the thing. So I was working on that for quite a bit, and always making notes for poems and rewriting poems and working on drafts of poems, tinkering with those. And I also have been writing essays of late. A recent one was on a trip to Ethiopia, specifically to Lalibela. So the travel form, kind of strange thinking about travel now in a period when travel is put on halt. But these sort of reflections on travels in prose I have been doing. And so, things like that, a variety of things. I like to keep a lot of things going at the same time, even though really my ultimate focus, where my attention is truly being sharpened is where the poems are concerned, because that's what takes up the my primary imaginary attention.
So let's hear from one of your books. First, an older poem you're going to read. We have two older poems and one newer poem. Can you tell me a little bit about the first one, or just read the title and the poem if you want?
Well, not a lot to say. It's a poem that it's called Montale's Lemon, and it's the Montale there is the Italian poet, the great Italian poet, contemporary poet, Eugenio Montale, a poet that I absolutely adore and was fortunate to come to his work a long time ago. And it's a poem in homage to him, but in a sense, reflecting on my own landscape. He's a poet who was so invested in his broadly the human condition as he encountered it in his own Italy of the 20th century, and developed a very personal language to confront this rather abstract notion of the human condition, going through various kinds of historical shifts. But one of the things that I adore about Montale is his concentration on the landscape, the very sensual world of his coastal landscape, and so on. And so the fruits, the trees, the soil, and so and those things are a major part of his poetry. They populate them, and he's able to eavesdrop on what the natural world is doing. And which is not completely a thing of what would say a kind of nature writing seeking out beauty, but rather attending to the horror contained, even a sublime horror, the kind of way in which beauty and truth are combined, and one is not located in a sphere of beauty alone or a sphere of truth alone, but this how they are configured. So this poem is called Montale's Lemons. My first snow. I opened the pages of Montale, the scent of iron and light coming out of heads of lemon trees in the middle of an orchard where raucous boys play, not hearing the eel quiet laureate who roams under a sky dappled with rust. He comes through the gate, plucks a canthus, unburdening himself of the city and the classics left in his study. Standing still, his shadow moves to branches brushing earth, freckling it with flame. Montale stoops, inflect leaves to a flickering secret, and what could be translated as winter fixes a spire in my chest, and my eyes go low down with that crouching tower. I cling to a still revolving truth. The world is a golden calyx, but home is a burst lemon, a child weeping at the cane root.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you read that one. And, I can't help but think, and I know we're just looking through that lens now, but as you read now, on this date, April 22nd in 2020, the poem also has another layer, doesn't it, in this context? It's almost like being in the post 9/11 world and what it meant to as a new context. It seems like now that poem, I don't want to reach too far here, but has another layer of meaning in a world where, especially the very last words, the difference between what's out there and what's home. I mean, of course, completely different meaning in the poem, but do you feel that things are now read with different shades of meaning because of this day that we're in?
Oh, absolutely. There is no way not to not hear in Dante or Shakespeare or Emily Dickinson our own moment being given to us. And that's the gift of poetry, in that it sounds almost like a cliche, the timelessness of it. Whatever kind of psychic pressure they wrote out of, or and the realities of their own personal lives, the kind of privacy of the poet, is acutely met in a future reader, right? The disturbances that shook their world might obviously be so different from ours, but nonetheless, there's something irreducible about the music of poetry that it finds its present tense in the future, right? It's constantly listening in on the breath of a new reader, and so it's always fresh, right? And the history that the poem comes out of will certainly become a past. It will fade into the sands of time, but out of every new encounter, meaning every new eyes that scan a line, every new breath that recites the line, it is speaking to that very current moment. It's always prescient, a poem, a very good poem, and the poet is trying to strive towards that difficult and never guaranteed status wherein the poem might live beyond the poet. So that's probably the primary first function of the poet, which is egotistical, one could say, but it certainly is a way to hold humanity and value the human spirit as something that must be endured despite or in spite of the tragedies of history.
So true and well put. Thank you for that. That's very beautifully put. And let's move on to another poem. You have another poem from one of your collections that you're going to read?
Yes, I thought maybe I would read section 3 of a poem called The Lords and Commons of Summer, which is sort of the title poem, in a sense, of the collection called House of Lords and Commons. And, you know, similarly to that poem that I just read, and this poem that I will read, I suppose there's a kind of 10 years between them. But something you sort of mentioned there, the kind of exilic condition that the poet is writing under, being away from home but not being away at the same time, where home is like a Moloch's shell or something. Wherever the poet finds the self, home is there. But of course, the fact that that it's not the actual home has to deal with the condition of being removed. It's a sort of diasporic dispersal, right? That I think it's common in Caribbean poetry, which even written in the Caribbean, there's always sort of in the background a sense of being from somewhere else, even if that is a matter of history, just the kind of historical truth that we were all brought there by force or other means. So the homeland, even though one is pretty sure that this is my home, I am a Jamaican, there's still always that distant echo of, but what of that other place? The absolute terrifying thing is that one has no way to completely answer that question, right? You don't have the language to speak back to this question that is constantly being put forward. And though you can say in a kind of abstract way, one is of African heritage. But what does that mean precisely? Where exactly, and so on. And these things might, then become a kind of, there are ways that the fear there is to not hear the questions as ironic, but being remaining faithful to a kind of sincerity within these, because in a sense this question is not unique to the Caribbean itself, but a kind of global the kind of in literature the global feeling of being sort of expelled from Eden. We're all sort of fallen beings, and we've been placed in geographies and left to wonder what was the original, and so on. So it's not unusual in a way, but in the particular and peculiar the history of the Caribbean gives this question its own sort of intensity. So anyways, this poem, section 3 of The Lords and Commons of Summer. A furnace in my father's voice. I prayed for the coal stove's roses. A cruise ship lit like a castle. On fire in the harbor we never walked. Father and son. Father drifting down the ferned hill. His shanty shun. Where inside in my head the lamp was the lamp. The market, the park, the library. Not a soul but grandmother's morning wash lifting towards heaven. Her flapping winding sheets. The barrister's son punished my sister. I stared at my hand. In a book, the horizon declined in my mouth. A hawk's scream tied all the hills together. My little earthshaker, visored in placenta, wonder of wonders, tremulous in amniotic shield, ensouled already, father in the veritable night, without house or harbor. Soon sea in a voice will harrow a scorpion's blaze in me to the marrow.
Thank you so much, Tyson.
Thank you.
I think I should leave that poem on its own instead of asking more about it. It's such a it's a favorite poem of mine. So beautiful, so evocative. You have one more to read. Yeah. It's fine to talk about it, but for me, the this idea also of father as a furnace is it's just lovely and to me terrifying. And I am a father, so I get it, and it's just like, wow, it's such a difficult thing to cover in a way, and but just the music of it, yeah, very, very beautiful piece.
Thank you. It's that thing, you put clay in fire, and it's hardened, and you're making something that is so delicate that requires such an intense heat. And liable to be broken, to be damaged, But the fire is also a sort of a perfecting, a cleansing force. And if it functions the way it should, then all shall be well. So for me, what sets me on fire is that poetry that is fully immersed in a contradiction that is not in itself a contradiction, right? That redeems its contrary surface and opens up layers of meanings, and I mean that's just life in itself. everything is a meeting of other things. And I think a poem becomes such a crystallizing force of this notion. And we're lucky to be readers that can sit with the simultaneities and be disturbed, but at the same time be comforted.
Mm. Yes, it is fortunate for all of us. That's so true. And there's one more you're reading. Is this, can you tell me a little bit about that if you'd like to read that? I think that's a current poem. One that's not published?
It has been published in the Paris Review, I think, maybe a year ago or two. And it's a sequence in three parts, not long. And I think I'll just read it and perhaps say something after that. The title is A Horace to Horace. 1. Loss causes confound. Where are you, cousin, since you swung upside down the iron gate outside school? The earth is your sky. Correct me. Was. I blame the missionaries. I blame myself for forgetting the words below Annie Bullerton's fluent drawings. You drew blank, swung and swung. The hinges gnashing in my ears wing out her maximum expression with a minimum of lines. Impossible, but wait a while. Me. Undermine the upper classes? What upper classes exactly? Copper isn't gold, nor is there a meadow or a brook in those crannies wedged on hillside plots. Schemes, excuse me, cinder blocks and grills, artillery teetered like upholstered derelicts amid fruit trees. They too are survivors. They live off the blood franchise I refuse with undue respect to forgive and move on. 3. Even the best possible outcome, you flew an avenging angel's speed, was possible. Forgive me. Ivory shade burns your steep descent up the shortcut bearing our trampled anonymity. Over frugal marigolds and devil's horsewhips. When progress takes hold, in whatever form, it will be belated and advance nothing. I insist you stride on air, fierce, tender. Thank you.
Thank you, Aishan. So tell me, I know you wanted to say something after this poem. Very, very beautiful poem. And it's so nice to hear you read this. It's so clear, and your voice, and nice to hear it being read. What about
you.
This poem? What should we say?
I appreciate that. You know, clarity is, I'm glad you said it about clear. I appreciate that because, I am writing in search of that clarity, right? Understanding that the Caribbean space has a kind of clarity about it, a chronological shape that is easy to get, but when one lives the experience of a Caribbean self, there's anything but clarity. There's precisely a crisis of clarity, right? This fragmentary reality, that's something that the pieces don't always go together. And when one lives in a small place, you feel the sharpness of the pieces not going together, whether that be in class differences, you know, because the space is so small, to have a so-called upper class next to a so-called lower class living in such close vicinity, the disparities are just too alarming. But there's a way that at times one can ignore them, or they are ignored in the general political atmosphere, right? And so one sometimes grew up with a kind of ignorance of these, a kind of knowing ignorance of the class differences, for instance. And then at some point, inevitably, one begins to question and demand some sort of redress of this condition, you know. And I was, in a sense, recalling through a kind of very intimate experience based in a sort of classroom, specifically in a primary school, where you're beginning the journey of education, and without the tools to really go forward, and yet the subject here, the cousin, is being blamed for not being able to learn, and seen as a really, to be frank, as an idiot, when in a sense nothing was ever provided for this person to learn. And it's not that this person is incapable of learning, and in fact has a kind of ingenuity to and depends a lot on his ingenuity to survive and live happily, but within the artificial, and then you have that sort of colonial and, you know, frankly, kind of a Christian colonized space of the classroom, where the person starts to doubt whether or not the cousin starts to doubt whether or not he in fact has a brain, and, you know, to really come to that realization, not in the moment of the experience, but a little bit after, is devastating, you know. And so this is somewhat some of the background kind of driving a poem like this, the sort of disenfranchised space, and yet still holding on to the fiercely, tenderly, and optimistic force that someone who has been maligned nonetheless gathers and never gives up on the self going through this.
Thank you for saying that. That just feels very good to hear right now as well. I want to ask you one more question before we go, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
I am reading too many things at the moment at once. We began by talking about Montale, and I read that sort of homage to Montale. And this recently I've been reading and rereading all of what I can on Montale, his poetry, which I've studied, read closely in various translations, and somehow feel the need to immerse myself again in the Montalian spirit. And of course, once you immerse yourself in Montale, inevitably you have to turn to Dante, his great predecessor. And so, along with Montale, I've just not too long ago, read this fantastic biography of Dante by the scholar John Took. It's monumental and wonderful. I also have been reading Thomas Mann's Joseph and His Brothers. I thought, why not? With the shutdown, one needs a big operatic book. And for that,
yes.
It's, I don't know, it's what, 1,500 pages. So it's been good. At the beginning of this, I started to read at the suggestion of a friend, reread Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, and sort of highlighting passages together with these two friends, exchanging notes on passages. And earlier we were just talking about the way that I would say that great writing shapes our future in that way, but in how Defoe's 17th century observation of the plague in England is almost a report on the pandemic now. You know, you tinker with the language, and here we are. It's clarifying and trying to clarify precisely what is happening at our current moment. So that was very edifying and in a strange way, it provided some degree of comfort.
But what has given me the most comfort, really, is returning to the poetry of Eugenio Montale, the Italian poet whom we began this conversation talking about. And I would like to end the program by reciting one of my favorite poems by Montale. It's called La Bufera, or The Storm. And the translation I am going to give is by Jeffrey Hill. The storm. The storm that batters the magnolia's impermeable leaves. The long-drawn drum roll of Martian thunder with hails. Crystal acoustics trembling in your night lairs disturb you while the gold transfumed from the mahoganies, the pages rims of deluxe books, still burns a sugar grain under your eyelids' shell. Lightning that makes stark white the trees, the walls suspending them, interminable instant, marbled manner and cataclysm, deep in you sculpted, born now as condemnation. This binds you closer to me, strange sister, than any love. So the harsh buskins, bashings of castanets and tambourines around the spoiler's ditch, fandango's foot rap, and overall, some gesture still to be defined, as when you turned away and cast in with a hand that cloudy mass of hair from your forehead, gave me a sign, and stepped into the dark. Thank you.
Aishan, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.